This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight...
In Kenya, the call for the government to act on extrajudicial killings and disappearances is growing by the day.
That's Mohamed Yusuf reporting. Details coming up also. In Gabon's presidential election, incumbent Ali Bongo has been declared the winner. And more anti-government protests anticipated as Zimbabwe's riot police patrol the streets of Harare today. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour in Gabon. Incumbent Ali Bongo has been declared the winner in Saturday's presidential election. The country's interior minister made the official announcement today. The election commission finally approved the results today after delaying the announcement from yesterday. The delay appeared to be related to a disputed vote count in a province where Mr. Bongo's Tiki ethnic group is the majority. A commission member blamed technical and verification issues. Bongo, who's 57, will now serve a second seven-year term in office. He was challenged by former African Union head Zon Ping, who's 73. Mr. Ping's party has demanded a recount in the disputed province. AFP reports election commission members took a secret ballot in approving the results, but opposition delegates reportedly abstained. One report says the margin of victory in Gabon's election was about 5,600 votes. In Zimbabwe, riot police are patrolling the streets of Harare and other major cities today in anticipation of more anti-government protests. However, despite calls for a shutdown by opposition groups, shops and offices are reported open as usual. Last Friday, police used tear gas and water cannon to disperse demonstrators in the capital. About 70 protesters have been charged with public violence. Among those arrested was Promise Makwananzi, leader of the Tajamuku movement. Police took the action despite a court order allowing the demonstrations. AFP reports that President Robert Mugabe vowed on Saturday to end the protests over high unemployment and unpaid salaries. Also, media reports say Movement for Democratic Change leader Morgan Tsvangirai has rejected state media claims that the MDC is training youth terror squads to fight the government. A party spokesman says the MDC has been the victim of state-sponsored violence, thuggery, and banditry. In Kenya, the call for the government to act on extrajudicial killings and disappearances is growing by the day. For VOA, Mohamed Yusuf reports.
This week, the body of a nurse who disappeared 10 days ago was discovered in a morgue in central Kenya. According to local media, investigators say the body had injuries on the hands and neck, showing signs of torture. Extrajudicial killings and disappearances like this continue in Kenya, despite the push by human rights organizations and Western governments for Kenya's government to investigate and end such incidents. Kenyan security agencies have denied accusations they are responsible for the killing, but blame rogue police officers. The head of the Independent Medical Legal Unit in Kenya, Peter Kiama, says the killings of civilians by police have increased.
We have a situation that seems to be getting out of hand. This has become a serious national crisis. We continue to see people within the criminal justice system disappearing in the hands of the police, and also, you know, increased cases of misuse of firearms by the police that leads to extrajudicial executions, but also increasing cases of extrajudicial executions through strangulation by police officers.
In July, Kenyans were outraged and took to the streets when a human rights lawyer, his client, and a taxi driver were tortured and killed, allegedly by police officers. Four administration police officers are facing murder charges. Last week, gunmen thought to be police officers walked into a hospital in Mwingi in eastern Kenya and killed a patient who was being treated of a gunshot wound. Kenyan media report the sister of the victim who witnessed the shooting went into hiding after receiving threats. Kiama says that is not unusual.
Witnesses to these cases have become under threat, and families who would like to seek justice are increasingly getting threats even within their households, being visited by suspects and supporters of the suspect to silence them.
A recent Human Rights Watch report documented 34 disappearances in the past 2 years in the hands of different security agencies. The group's Kenyan researcher Otisiana Namwaya says the government needs to form a commission to investigate these cases.
We know that this problem of killings and disappearances is a much bigger problem, and that's why we think that we need to have a thorough investigation that looks at this problem holistically. So if a commission of inquiry is established, people will actually begin to see something that looks like an investigation, and people will finally get to know at least the extent of the problem.
Security authorities say all the cases of missing individuals and killings will be investigated and action will be taken. Nine police officers are facing murder charges in connection with the killings of civilians in the past 2 months. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
About 13,000 migrants have arrived in Italy over the past few days after being rescued on the Mediterranean. Most of the rescue operations took place off the coast of Libya. The Italian Navy says on one of the rescue vessels, a Nigerian woman asked the ship's captain to baptize her three-month-old baby. A woman lieutenant and a rear admiral stood in as the child's godparents. In other news, Reuters reports Pope Francis will play a bigger role in the migrant and refugee crisis. A Vatican statement says four humanitarian-related offices will be combined to deal with the issue. The Pope would temporarily take direct charge of migration issues. The changes are to take effect in January. You were listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. In Gabon's presidential election, incumbent Ali Bongo has been declared the winner. More anti-government protests anticipated as Zimbabwe riot police patrol the streets of Harare today. And after being rescued on the Mediterranean, 13,000 migrants have arrived in Italy over the past few days. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Tunisia's Interior Ministry says police killed two suspected jihadi terrorists yesterday in the western part of the country and seized weapons and a suicide belt. The two men were known to police and had been on a terrorist wanted list. They died in a shootout that lasted from yesterday until early this morning. Police say a civilian also was killed in the gun battle after being struck by a stray bullet fired by one of the jihadists. The raid comes just 2 days after an ambush and a military patrol in a remote mountain area in nearby Kasserine. Three soldiers were killed and eight others were wounded. The Al-Qaeda-linked group Akba Abi Nafa claimed responsibility. A new government of national unity took power Monday in Tunisia. Prime Minister Youssef Chahid is the country's youngest ever leader. He and his new cabinet face major economic and security challenges in the birthplace of the Arab Spring. Earlier this month, lawmakers voted of no confidence in the government of Habib Isid following just 18 months in office. Among those following developments in Tunisia is Radwan Masmoudi, president of the Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy. He spoke to VOA's Mohamed El Shenawi about what prompted the no confidence vote in the previous cabinet.
I think what prompted the move to change the government was the feeling that the situation in Tunisia is not improving, especially on the economic front. The government of Isid has not made a significant dent in improving the economic situation. Economic growth is less than 1%, and the expectation of the young people have not been met. There is a lot of dissatisfaction. Also, there is growing corruption in Tunisia, and there is a feeling that the government of Asid has not been attempting to stop corruption. And in general, I think the problem with the Asid government has been communication. The prime minister and his government have not done a good job of explaining to the Tunisian people the program of the government or the efforts of the government on several fronts.
How would differently the new cabinet deal with the economic challenges of poverty and unemployment?
Only time will tell whether the new government will be able to face these very, very difficult economic situation, especially the problem of unemployment, which has actually grown in the past year. This is, a top priority for the government, and this is why there is a need and there is a support for this government across the political spectrum from various political parties. This is why it's called a government of national unity. For the first time since the revolution, we have 7 political parties and 3 major national organizations that are supporting this government. We will see exactly what, if anything, the government will do differently from the Asid government. But we hope that because the government is more energetic and has more young people, has more new blood, and has more support from political parties, that it will be more forceful and will implement the reforms and the changes that need to take place a lot faster than what happened last year.
Why security is still a huge problem in Tunisia?
No, I think security has improved a lot in Tunisia. We haven't had a terrorist attack for almost a year or a year and a half. But of course, terrorism remains a problem everywhere in the world, including in Europe and in the United States. So despite the fact that the security in Tunisia has improved tremendously in the past couple of years and has done a great job of dismantling terrorist activities and terrorist networks and protecting the border, this does not mean that there will not be terrorist attacks in Tunisia.
How could the United States help Tunisia to be the success story of the Arab Spring?
I think the United States can do a lot to help Tunisia. I think there is a genuine desire to help Tunisia in the United States and across Europe. But I don't think the United States has done enough to help Tunisia or Europe. I think Tunisia needs more economic support. I think Tunisia needs a Marshall Plan. Tunisia needs a significant amount of money to infuse the economy, to strengthen the economy, to stabilize the economy. The $100 or $140 million that the United States has been giving per year to Tunisia is really an insignificant amount of money. Tunisia needs a lot more support, and that money should go to build the infrastructure in the interior of the country. This is where the main problem is. There are no jobs, there is no economy, there is no industry, there is no agriculture in the interior of the country. So Tunisia needs a huge amount of money to build the infrastructure of the country. And this will later on attract investors also to the interior of the country to give hope and jobs to the young people in Tunisia who are hoping for a better future. It takes time, but Tunisia needs economic support right now to face these huge expectations and challenges.
That's Radwan Masmoudi, president of Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy. He spoke to VOA's Mohamed El Shenawi. This is World Water Week, and representatives of 130 countries have gathered in Stockholm to discuss sustainable water use and global conservation. The issue is relevant for Malawi, where deforestation and drought are endangering crops and causing water levels in Lake Malawi to drop. VOA's Adam Phillips reports on the problem and what one small NGO is doing to help.
40 years ago, Malawi was one of the most lushly forested places in the world. But in recent decades, villagers have been clearing forests for firewood and to create new farmland. Jeffrey Ferber is the co-founder of Ripple Africa, a Malawi-based environmental conservation group. He says this is having a catastrophic effect on the amount of rainfall in Malawi and the region.
Because when it rains, it just sort of trickles through the trees into the leaf mulch underneath. And then the trees obviously then take up the moisture as they need it and make the air moist, which then produces clouds and you get more rainfall and the rainfall's on your crops. And that's just not happening in lots of parts of sub-Saharan Africa now.
Normally, forest root systems hold the soil in place. But in Malawi, where huge swaths of forest are being cut down, the soil gets washed away. The runoff clogs rivers and streams, and ultimately Lake Malawi, on which millions depend for food. Forrest Ngwiri, Ripple Africa's environmental program manager in Malawi, describes it as both a natural and a national tragedy.
If I can take you to the lake, you come during rainy season, you find that the beautiful water, it is turning to yellow just because of the soil erosion. We are losing the beauty of the country. I personally, as a Malayan, when I see this, I feel very, very sorry for myself. Because as a Malayan, we depend on these natural resources. If we don't have enough trees in Malawi, that means we will not have enough food. It's like killing your own life.
Recently, a Malawian military contingent of 900 soldiers was called in to prevent people from illegally cutting trees for firewood and charcoal to sell.
They have done the right thing to involve the Malawi army to take part in the conservation of the forest, because otherwise the land will be left bare.
Jeffrey Ferber doubts that 900 soldiers can effectively guard the 4,000 square kilometers of forest they must patrol. In any case, Ferber believes that to be effective, conservation and law enforcement must be grassroots efforts, not government ones.
You've got to get people to take ownership of it. Like if you've just got one small hill, and the people that live around this hill, and you make them realize the value of the trees on that hill, and say, you're responsible for protecting these. So if anybody comes to cut down things illegally, you've got to do something about it. That, I think, works. But if you rely on the government doing it, they'll do it when they're being paid, but there isn't money in the future. There isn't going to be money in the future to do it.
Only 5% of Malawi's population has access to electricity. Even when the electricity grid is accessible, most Malawians cannot afford the fees. In Ferber's view, that is unlikely to change.
So if you want to boil some water or you want to cook your supper, you have to use either firewood or charcoal. And so typically they've used what they call a three-stone fire, where they have three bricks and put wood in from each corner. And it uses a huge amount of firewood, probably about three bundles, big bundles that women carry on their heads every week.
That's why one of Ripple Africa's key projects is the distribution of a fuel-efficient cook stove.
And this just uses one bundle of wood. And in our district, we have 40,000 of these stoves, so we're saving about 80,000 bundles of wood every week.
Ripple Africa also promotes the creation of tree nurseries, which produce trees that can be harvested for firewood or sold and then replanted. And Ferber says that composting, rather than burning things during the dry season, will help reduce the smoky carbon emissions that contribute to global warming and help preserve the precious forest land that remains. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
The World Health Organization warns of a growing threat of antibiotic resistance to three common sexual transmitted infections. The WHO is issuing updated guidelines on treatments that nations should follow to reduce their spread and improve sexual and reproductive health. Lisa Schlein reports on the new guidelines from Geneva.
Chlamydia, gonorrhea, and syphilis are major public health problems. The World Health Organization estimates the three sexually transmitted diseases together infect more than 200 million people globally every year. Chlamydia, which can cause infertility in both men and women, infects 131 million people. The WHO says those who come down with this common bacterial infection frequently also have gonorrhea. And that poses a particular problem because antibiotic resistance is most widespread and growing most rapidly in the treatment of gonorrhea. Medical Officer Teodora Wee in the WHO's Department of Reproductive Health and Research says WHO guidelines issued in 2003 recommended the antibiotic quinolones for the treatment of gonorrhea. She says the new guidelines advise against using this drug.
And in most countries in Africa, they still continue to use quinolones because it's a WHO recommendation. And we know that there's already very high resistance to this. So that's why we need to update this and say quinolones could not be used anymore.
We says other safe, effective treatments are available. While a relatively small 5.6 million people are infected with syphilis, its potential impact can be devastating. Fetal death can result if a pregnant woman transmits syphilis to her fetus. In 2012, the WHO reports untreated syphilis infections in pregnant women caused an estimated 200,000 stillbirths and neonatal deaths. The new WHO guidelines recommend a single dose of benzathine penicillin. Health officials say the injectable antibiotic is the most effective treatment for syphilis and cheaper than oral antibiotics. While the guidelines recommend safe, effective medical treatments for chlamydia, gonorrhea, and syphilis, the WHO notes condoms remain one of the most effective methods of protection against sexually transmitted infections when used correctly and consistently. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Ruhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24-7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nick Ivanov, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Next edition of Straight Talk Africa, an in-depth discussion on democracy and the rule of law in Uganda. Join us right here on Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.
The political process that determines who the next president of the United States will be? Tune in to VOA's extensive coverage of the campaigns, the voting, and the final tallying to find out how citizens choose their next president. Right here on VOA.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bungani in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people. Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, the African Union, can't these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at UpfrontAfrica.